We humans are driven throughout the day by a wide range of motivations, and not all motivations are equally good for us. A quick feel-good reward from a trinket that is bright and shiny, or a deeper joy from pursuing and enjoying that which is true, good, and beautiful. Education in many ways is about forming healthy motivations in our children and in ourselves. From habits in our homes to classroom routines, what drives what we love, and how do we as parents and educators effectively and appropriately motivate our children's actions and behaviors? And in the process, how do we avoid the temptations to use the all too common and unhealthy carrots and sticks or rewards and punishment methods? All this and more on this episode of Basecamp Live.
Mountains, we all face them as we seek to influence the next generation. Get equipped to conquer the challenges, summit the peak, and shape exceptionally thoughtful, compassionate, and flourishing human beings. We call it Ancient Future Education for raising the next generation. Welcome to Basecamp Live. Now your host, Davies Owens.
Welcome to Basecamp Live. Davies Owens here. So good to be with you on yet another episode. We have a lot in store in this discussion of what motivates us. It's always good to ask ourselves, what does motivate our behavior, whether it's what gets us out of bed in the morning, what guides our decisions throughout the day, or what motivated you to listen to this podcast? Hopefully, it's because it's a place that you're being encouraged and finding effective and guiding principles for raising up the next generation. That's certainly my intention and my motivation for being here with you today. We are, as always, interested in what's on your mind. We're going through a lot of thoughts right now about the long-awaited version 2.0 of Basecamp Live, which will include video and other additional elements to the podcast. Always good to hear from you. What's helpful to you in terms of topics, formats? What do you enjoy as part of the types of topics that we take on? We've recently added this McCurdy's FAQs. And so good reminder there, info@basecamplive.com. Questions for Keith McCurdy. We have him on once a quarter. In the past, we've done things like the Climber series where we've actually had various listeners, those of you out there who are willing to jump on for a 5-minute quick short story of just who you are, where you're working, what God is doing in your life in terms of your involvement with raising the next generation in classical Christian schools. We're definitely interested in hearing from you. Before we jump into this episode, an interview with Jason Barney, just as always, want to say a big thank you to the many sponsors that have come alongside Basecamp Live: CAP, Classical Academic Press, CLT, the Classic Learning Test, the Focus Group, and the Good Agency. And also want to give a special shout out in this episode to Hildegard College. They're beginning their very first college incoming class, which I encourage you to take a look at, Dallas Baptist University and Excel College. These are three great choices in terms of college decisions, and they're all really kindred spirits with what we're doing in the classical Christian school movement. Jason Barney serves as the principal of the Coram Deo Academy in Carmel, Indiana. In 2012, he was awarded the Henry Salvadori Prize for Excellence in Teaching from Hillsdale College. He has an MA in Biblical Exegesis from Wheaton, and he's also been teaching in the classroom. So both a theorist and a very much a practitioner, teaching Latin, humanities, senior thesis, third through 12th grade. He is a quite prolific writer and publisher. His book, A Classical Guide to Narration, written with the Searcy Institute, which, by the way, about a year ago, I interviewed him on. I'm a big fan of narration, which is a big Charlotte Mason practical tool for how to teach in the classroom. Jason has also written The Joy of Learning and several other books along the way. He is a frequent speaker at conferences at SCL and ACCS and Searcy, as well as classes he's taught on Classic U. And Jason is just very much an enthusiast for what we're doing and a wonderful thinker. He blogs regularly on ancient wisdom for the modern era at the classical or educationalrenaissance.com. He'll mention more of this. He also has a podcast as well as his blog there. So without further ado, this is my interview on the topic of motivation with Jason Barney. Jason Barney, welcome back to Basecamp Live.
It's so great to be with you today, Davies, to talk about motivation.
Well, I'm not motivated. You got to motivate me to be inspired now to, no, I'm just kidding. I'm always motivated.
It's a tall order, you know? Motivation is tricky, right? It's not always there.
Well, that's, you know, let's just jump in on this because on the one hand, you know, we think of ourselves, especially Basecamp Live listeners, parents, educators in classical Christian schools. And, you know, we think about the great books and the great materials that we put before our students. You and I have talked before, you were on about a year ago talking about our friend Charlotte Mason and her emphasis on narration, and kind of under the big banner, if you will, of this idea that we classical folks do a pretty good job of identifying excellent content, but I think we stumble a bit trying to figure out sometimes how to actually educate well, be it in the classroom or to parent well. Like, how do we actually do it? And we sometimes fall back in the classroom to maybe sort of progressive methods of education that we grew up under, or in our home, maybe, you know, whatever the latest parenting YouTube best practice is. So we need to today, I think, get to back kind of in that category of how do we do this is really motivation. So Jason, what is motivation? I mean, why is that important in your thinking?
Well, just like you said, motivation is so crucial to everything that we're doing as human beings. And as we are parents and educators, we want to motivate our students, our children, to act in particular ways, to live in particular ways. We want them to be motivated too. And unfortunately, we live in a world that has relied on a lot of extrinsic motivators. And we've probably been bred in those sorts of extrinsic motivators too. And I mean, what I have in mind here, for instance, is carrots and sticks, right? Rewards and punishments. And there's a sense in which they are inevitable. There are good reasons to have rewards and punishments for different sorts of behavior, because there are behaviors that are less than helpful and rewards can help get that going in a better direction. And there are behaviors that are great that you want to see rewards for. And obviously, from a Christian perspective, we want to think in terms of the fact that rewards and punishments are in the Bible too. So they're not wrong in and of themselves, but there are better and worse rewards and punishments. And maybe to kind of highlight the problem for us, I remember when I was in a big public school growing up that in my seventh grade math class, my teacher would give us gummy worms with sparkling crystals of sugar on them as a reward at the end of every math class.
Wow.
And it struck me as strange at the time, but it was something that became big because of behaviorism in the school system. And it's kind of gotten its way into so many different things. Just the idea that I would finish my math work in math class in order to get a gummy worm treat is, to me now as a classical educator of many years, absurd. But that's the equivalent that we're sometimes at, even if it's more subtle. We're using rewards in ways that are less than helpful. And I think the problem there is what it says about math, right? Instead of assuming that I'm going to want to solve those math problems and understand math and be curious and learn and be a hardworking person, it assumes that I'm something more like a rat that needs to be manipulated into doing this little bit of work. Otherwise, I'm not going to want to do it on my own, which is a really negative view of human beings, I think.
Well, I keep thinking about 30 minutes later when you were in your English class after your math class and all the sugar sparklies kicked in and what that teacher had to deal with as far as everybody bouncing off the wall from the gummy worms. But, you know, the idea of motivation, there is, you know, we always say there's no neutral education. You're being educated. It's just a matter of in what and in how. And it seems like motivation is kind of the same idea. There's no point at which you're not motivated. You may be uninspired or you may be motivated by the wrong things. I came across a quote from Homer, 800 BC, a hungry stomach will not allow its owner to forget it, whatever his cares and sorrows. And it's almost kind of a Maslow's hierarchy of need. Obviously, if you're starving, you're probably not very interested in building friendships or, you know, thoughtful discussions. So obviously we need to feed our kids, but it does seem like, you know, we often think of motivation either we, to your point, problematically, or we use it problematically, but really educators are motivators. And so again, let's, you know, keep going with this because I think it's a fascinating point, and I should say not just educators, but parents in our homes. And we'll get into some of the problems. Actually, let's just jump right in. I mean, Jason, what do you see? That was a good example of in your classroom with the gummy worms. I mean, where do you see this maybe improper motivation being used in homes?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the books that's really informed some of my thinking on rewards and motivations is actually a New York Times bestseller. Daniel Pink wrote a book called Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. And I found that really interesting. If you as a parent like reading this sort of literature, I'd say pick up a copy of Drive if you want to dive into this topic more. But one of the things he talks about is these different levels of motivation and how motivation at the carrots and sticks level, that extrinsic motivation, is pretty low. And the thing about carrots and sticks is that they work for a time. And they work for certain sorts of things. So if you have low level, like menial activities that you just need to do and you need to crank out, if you get a reward for doing that, that's going to work well. That'll help you. And so a lot of this kind of motivational material kind of came out of a factory mindset of we just got to get people to do with what we want them to do. But the problem is that type of motivation doesn't work very well for highly creative things or things that involve a whole lot of deep thought, for instance. And so we are probably as parents all feel this in our own work and jobs, whatever they are, that right, we're dealing with motivation all the time. And when we are intrinsically motivated because of a greater purpose, a big picture why, that is so much more powerful in the long run for us. And we're motivated by relationships and by culture and all those things, not just by carrots and sticks. And so when modern education came along and made behaviorism the main kind of running idea that would make education work, we had some really negative effects, I think, come in. And of course, grades themselves are kind of new in the history of education, believe it or not. And they're a little bit of a mixed bag. Charlotte Mason, whom we've talked about before, talks about marks, what was called grades in her day in England, as our old enemy. And so grades, you know, we've seen actually not be motivating for kids. I mean, maybe you have a student who's getting a low grade in a particular area, and just by getting that grade didn't suddenly motivate your kid to, right, become excited about learning. But then we actually use these sorts of motivators, like paying a kid to do something when we really shouldn't be. So one of the things I remember reading in that book, Drive, is that when a student, say, is learning a new instrument and they're practicing on their own, if you offer to pay the student for practicing, they're actually less likely to practice as regularly when they're getting paid for it. And that just blew my mind, because you'd think, oh, wow, wouldn't that student even be more motivated to practice if they're going to be paid for practicing, right? Like they're going to get some allowance on the side. And the ironic thing is that, no, we're really complex as human beings. And when you say that you're going to pay me for something, that tells me that I probably wouldn't want to practice my instrument on my own, right? We have to think about the implicit messages that we're sending our kids.
So I want to differentiate, because you made an interesting point referencing Daniel Pink's book Drive when you talked about there are times, maybe in limited situations, for instance, if you're at a conference and, hey, we're going to give away an Amazon gift card if you fill out the survey. So potentially that kind of a moment, a single moment motivator is not a problem. It works, versus the normal way you motivate your kid to play violin is they get paid every week. I mean, so I guess it's frequency. Is that kind of a big differentiator?
I do think the frequency of something is going to matter. You know, I also draw from a book, Start With Why, by Simon Sinek. And he talks about marketing manipulations. And what we've learned about those sorts of things, too, is that, yeah, like they'll drive a transaction, but they won't necessarily create loyalty. And so, of course, as parents, you know, we're not trying to sell things to our kids. We're not engaging in that sort of behavior, but we are communicating messages to them when we, you know, use some sort of reward for an activity. And so we just really need to be careful. Like, you actually want your kids' loyalty long term. You want to lead their hearts and souls. And so you have to be careful before you think through. And maybe you're doing this right now as a parent, right? Like, you're thinking to yourself, oh man, I offered to pay my kid a particular amount if they got all A's, right? That's kind of the stereotypical parent situation where, you know, you want your kid to legitimately care about school, to do their best, to work hard, and throwing a little bit of extra cash there and making them work for it sounds like it's creating some drive in them. And I'm not saying that it'll always backfire if you do something like that. But I do think that you have to keep in mind the broader context. And if you're actually trying to develop long-term intrinsic motivation and curiosity and love of learning and things like that, it is very possible that a tactic like that, if the student doesn't already love learning, might just backfire and end up communicating, hey, what you should really love in life is money. And even going back as far as John Locke, he says that's one of the worst messages you can send to your kids when you're talking about like learning, because you really want them to love learning for its own sake, to be curious, to become virtuous. And if you tell them that the things that matter most in life are, you know, money or pleasures or, you know, a new set of clothing or whatever else it is, a new video game system, right? If you give those things as rewards, you're actually kind of affirming to them that those are the things they should really love most.
But isn't part of it, and again, I'm trying to split hairs here, I guess, between when it is appropriate. And I can think of, you know, again, we're all human. So we're not just talking here theoretically about our students. We're like, what motivates us? And, you know, when I think about what motivates me, if I'm going to start a, you know, a new health regime or something, and it may be for 30 days, I'm going to go to the gym. And then at the end of that, I'm going to reward myself by going out to dinner with my wife or doing something. I mean, there's a different, I guess I would like to think, if I could use an analogy like that. I mean, there's some, the primary motivation there is getting healthy and the love of getting healthy. And then sort of an act of gratitude at the end for the hard work is you get this reward. So I guess if it's almost like an ordering of the affections of the priority. So if the leading reason, like when my dad waved $50 at me back in seventh grade, which was a lot of money way back then, to do well or get an A or something on Latin, which I didn't do, although I went on to do Hebrew and Greek. But the point is, it didn't work. I was all excited about the $50, but I never really learned to love. I get exactly your point, but can we potentially, again, have a blend where you're without crossing that line? It seems like it's kind of messy,
yeah,
to say the least.
I acknowledge that. I guess I would say maybe a way of solving that is thinking first in terms of relationship and culture, and those as the primary and deepest motivators. So when you do something with your kids, say as a parent, that's really fun, and you go out and spend money on them or give them money, that can be just a natural reward out of life and relationship together. It's when you make it as a reward for a particular activity that it feels potentially to the child like you're trying to manipulate them into a particular action. So I think for ourselves, we can do this game kind of where we motivate ourselves by giving ourselves rewards. I think that's great. And I think actually you could, in a relational conversation with your child, as you're sowing the idea of how they can grow in a particular way and how, yes, you may not love this thing, honey, but it's really good for you for these deeper reasons. What do you think would help you be inspired and motivated to grow at doing your best at this? Or, you know, and then you can have that conversation. And I think even if you did it in a particular way where you set up a reward that you two would do something fun together or get something for him or her, that could be so much more powerful because you're using say the reward is a relational bonding around things that matter together. And instead of it feeling like a transaction, right, it's something good. So yeah, I'm not anti rewards entirely, and I'm certainly not anti consequences. A way of making them natural and relational, I think, is going to sow the right seeds to bear fruit, good fruit in kids' lives long term.
Yeah. And well, before we go to a break, again, just kind of hitting home examples, I think that we're all familiar with. I can think of, you know, even not too long ago being in someone's home and on the refrigerator, there was the old behaviors and then the kids' names and the stars that were above them. And so clearly I've seen this in Sunday schools. I've seen this in certainly in classrooms where little Johnny read the book. Now you get to go put the gold star up. And it seems like that type of constant, like that is the end point of the whole thing, is to get that star. Then you get to go cash in 10 stars. You get to go to the treasure box and you get the toy. I mean, this stuff is so typical and universal that we almost don't see it, but it bleeds into everything. And so I think your point is, like, first of all, just be aware how natural it is and common it is to use those types of behaviorist manipulation tools, really.
Yeah. And there's a great story from Mark Twain, right? The beginning of Tom Sawyer. Tom is given the task of painting a fence. And of course, you know, he doesn't want to do this, but he knows human nature. So he goes out and starts painting the fence and whistling like he's having the best time in the world. And some of his friends walk by and see that he's having a great time painting the fence. And so he ends up, through the course of manipulating his friends, getting them to pay him for the privilege of painting the rest of that fence for him. Right. And so that just goes to show human nature, like what we value in community is so much more powerful of a motivator than simple carrots and sticks.
We're going to take a break. I want to come back and jump into this very idea, because what Tom Sawyer demonstrated there is he made something so intriguing and attractive and dynamic that, you know, it all of a sudden took on a whole quality beyond just painting a fence. And I think, what are we saying as parents, as educators, about the thing that we're desiring? And do we create an impression of something that's so beautiful and attractive, to love the good as it may be, that students are like, I want that. I get where we're going on this journey. So I really want to unpack further, how do we cast that vision in a way that students can catch hold of if they're not quite there yet, as they're still looking at the fence going, that looks like a lot of hard work. So I want to hear your thoughts on that. We'll be right back with Jason Barney.
Our promising young people need a new kind of college that cuts through the failings of the mainstream university and challenges them to turn their conviction into action. Introducing Hildegard College, a new classical Christian college that reclaims the fearless pursuit of the good and the true for the leadership and virtue we need from the next generation. Hildegard uniquely combines a classical liberal arts curriculum with an education in entrepreneurship. Our program is focused and affordable, created for young scholars who seek the rigor of classical education and also the practical knowledge they need to put their passion into practice. Hildegard is located in the cultural hub of Costa Mesa, California, and is currently accepting applications for its inaugural freshman class. Learn more at hildegard.college.
Hey there, I'm Jeremy Tate, founder of CLT, or the Classic Learning Test. Here at CLT, we are big fans of the Basecamp Live podcast, and we're honored to work alongside all of you in the classical renewal movement. In addition to our beautiful standardized assessments for grades 3 through 12, CLT also produces a podcast called Anchored that we think Basecamp listeners will enjoy as well. Anchored explores the intersection of education and culture, and it features conversations with leaders across the entire renewal movement, from college presidents and professors to heads of schools and organizational leaders. If you want to stay up to date on all that's been going on in education and in the renewal movement, please check out CLT's Anchored podcast, that's A-N-C-H-O-R-E-D, and visit our website at www.cltexam.com/basecamp.
Jason, we've been talking in first part there just about the fact we're not just educators and just parents, those are as important as those are. We're really in the motivation business, and we're up against a very powerful world outside our doors, or in some cases inside our doors, that have figured out quite well how to manipulate and motivate us to things that we didn't even know we needed. And that's really, I guess, the heart of marketing, is let's present things in front of people to make them desire it, even though they didn't know they needed it or wanted it. And so I wonder, in the corollary, if we're going to win the motivation battle, if you will, what are the ways we as parents and as educators, from your perspective, can put before students, not just here's the reading material, but cast such a vision that a student would say, I want that, and I'm going to stay the course, and I'm going to, even when it gets hard, because the reward on this is going to be so significant.
Yeah, I think that's the question. And I think it's the question that every set of parents should be asking themselves and discussing regularly, because at the end of the day, we want the hearts of our kids, right? And the heart is connected to their motivation and what they want in life and what they value. And that's really a lot of the big picture we're recovering in this classical Christian education movement, is that we want to go for kids' hearts. We don't just want them jumping through hoops to get into a particular college. We want a certain type of person to grow up. And so what they're motivated by and what they value matters so much. So I know, you know, on this podcast already, Davies, you guys talk a lot about culture and habits, but I feel like those two things are just the kind of touch points that I keep coming back to as I think about my own family culture and the particular habits that I want my kids to have. And so as we think as parents, and also in the classroom, for educators, what does it look like to set up a particular culture? How do you do that? How do you influence a culture that values particular things? And then the motivation kind of comes along with it. And so if you think, for instance, of your home, do you really want your kids to be readers? Well, what's that going to look like? How are you going to make them readers? Do you read yourself? Are you a reader? So there's like a first step, which is modeling as a parent. They are going to, of course, believe what we do before they believe what we say. And so if you really value certain things, and maybe you're not a reader, right? Maybe you listen to podcasts and, you know, you have other skills and gifts. So you don't want, like, reading doesn't function that same way in your family culture. But I think you want to think about it as a parent, like, what are the things I really want to pass on? For me, I'd think, you know, what does the Barney household look like? What does it look like to be a Barney, you know, for my kids 30 years from now? And if, you know, reading, say, is one of those, it certainly is for me. Like, we read aloud in the evenings. I love doing that for my kids. And that's so valuable. They love it. They want it, partly because we have that culture together. And of course, that develops habits in them. So I think having that time in the evening, I know, you know, it's hard to carve out time in the evening, but like really trying to prioritize family time, turn off the screens, you know, unless you're curating some content that you think is going to be wonderful for your family. But being intentional about the culture that you have, I think, is part of the long-term motivation game. And I think that's true in the classroom too. You know, at the school where I'm principal currently, we added what we call DEAR to the schedule for the whole school. So drop everything and read is DEAR. And we do 20 minutes of silent reading across the school. And it's so great to see these older students just stopping and reading absolutely silently, locked into their books, something that they love and enjoy. And that's part of how you create a motivation, right? It's like you have a culture around something and you create a habit so that they can build it right on their own. And again, just to give you an exact illustration of this and how it goes wrong too, I was just rereading in Drive where they did a particular study on adults doing like this puzzle thing. And, you know, they had brought them into some sort of lab and, you know, they did it 3 days in a row. And with one group in the middle of it, like the second time they had them come in, they said, okay, we're going to pay you for how many puzzles you solve. And then on the third time, they didn't have any money to pay them. And, what they saw is when the person who was administering the test kind of went out for a break, those who weren't being paid all through the three sessions Actually spent time during that like extra break when they didn't have to be working on the puzzles, they spent more and more time being engaged in trying to solve these puzzles because they were just really getting into it. They were developing this habit and delight in the puzzles for its own sake. So when they had free time, they used it that way. For the group where they paid them at the second session, you saw them be, of course, as you'd expect for that second session, really intense trying to do as many puzzles as they could that time. But then the third time when they weren't being paid, it dropped way down. They didn't care at all, right? Like the payment had kind of killed their interest in the puzzles, ironically, right? And so that's, I guess, just what we're talking about here. A habit will build. Like if you have a culture built into your family, you're going to give them an avenue of interest, of love, and it's going to grow over time. But if you use a shortcut, well, it'll work for a moment, but it might not. It might actually kill their interest in that area over the long haul. So I guess what I'd say there is we have to be patient as we build a particular culture and habits for our families.
Well, and I think as you're saying that, I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, do we ask ourselves the question, what is motivating my child in this moment? And is the motivation out of fear, or is it out of something, you know, is there an unnatural motivation? In your case, the example you just gave, you know, is a financial reason that drove that process. And I think that's probably something we don't ask ourselves enough when we're looking at what's stirring them up, what's driving them towards the behavior we want. And I could, you know, I think, you know, again, we talked in part one about some of the negatives where, you know, I know of students that were in a public school environment and they were very interested, raise their hand, ask a question, and learn pretty quickly. You don't ask intelligent questions because you're going to be snickered at by the row of the kids behind you, because that's not the currency they trade in. That's not what you're not motivated to want to ask important questions. So I think it's almost like asking, what are we celebrating? And is the celebration, again, the grade, or is the celebration that we all, to your point about the deer moment, we're all celebrating. Look around, all my peers are reading right now, and it's the currency we're trading in versus I'm trying to work against the grain of the community around me or the culture that I'm in. So I'm just trying to kind of lock in on what you're talking about. The habits and the culture have as much to do with this as anything. And if we're not paying attention to that, we're kind of undermining our efforts.
And that's so true, because we as human beings are always looking to those around us, especially when we're in a new environment, for them to tell us, hey, what's valuable here? What does this community think is worthwhile? And kids are so impressionable in that way, which is why we do want to be careful about what influences they are having at school. I mean, that's why many of us as parents are sending our kids to a classical Christian school, because we want an environment where the love of learning is celebrated and where there is curiosity, rather than the opposite being the case. I love how you brought up the idea of like fear as well, and other strong emotions can get in the way of a natural good relationship with something, some subject, some skill developing. So I think that's something that we should think about as parents and teachers too, is how can we get obstacles out of the way of our kids developing healthy relationships with school, with their studies, with sports, with, you know, all the other things that we might want them to have good relationships with. And so finding out how we can make sure to get rid of some of that fear, encourage them, you know, I think is important. Making sure that they're not bored, right? If something's way too easy and you get bored, it's going to be hard to have joy and develop a great motivation relationship with doing something, right? Like you almost want to give up if it's too easy. And so the challenge level is key as well. And I think we should keep in mind that idea, because it's related to motivation, that when you really develop a relationship with something, get really good at it, and you actually want it to be sort of challenging, right? We don't want to just as human beings be in a passive state of watching TV, say. Actually, we know from studies and research that that correlates with mild depression. We want to be challenged as human beings. Of course, you need rest time built into your day. And that is something that you should think about as a parent as well. We are a little bit, I might say, in this culture, overscheduled with the amount of things we want to push our children through. And so maybe the reason the motivation isn't there is they're just tired from being carted around to all sorts of activities that they should enjoy, right? So we should be a little bit countercultural here.
Well, I think it's a great reminder. Sometimes we miss the basics, like everyone's exhausted and we've overscheduled. Maybe that's why there's not motivation to dig in with joy to what we're learning. But I think, again, just as a parent, you use the word curiosity, and I think there's something it's worth kind of parking on that for a moment, because how do we stir up the connection between curiosity and being rightly motivated? To your point, I think too often we're boring people. We're boring them with the great books. We're boring them with theology. We're boring them with things that are interesting to us, but we've not figured out how to tap into, and I'm not talking about making it quote fun or entertaining, but how do we move students? There's a term that's, you know, in the business world, flow, or being, we hear the term being in the zone. It's sort of a mental state where we become so completely absorbed in the task or activity. I can think of times, you know, when I've been in the classroom and the bell rings and like no one's moving because we're so into this conversation. Now, you can't have that all the time, but talk a little bit about this, developing the right motivation around curiosity and driving us towards something that we really hit a flow state with.
Yeah. And I think that's great. I think Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's work on flow is so interesting. It's been big for a little while now, but the idea that, you know, you want your challenge level to be at, you know, enough, but not too much. You want to be kind of in a stretch zone, but not a snap zone, right? And also not too bored, right? Like you got to hit that right kind of challenge level. And when you do, your mind gets kind of sucked in and you go into this timeless state where you're just fully absorbed in a meaningful activity. And that's what we want in the classroom. And so, you know, great teachers sort of do this naturally, right? Like they feel the room and see where students are at and help explain or make something easier to them, give them one step along the way when they can see that it's just a little bit too much or too far above their heads. And likewise, they speed things up when things are almost too obvious at this moment. And so I think we want to, as parents, parent our students, our kids for flow as well, where we try and get them the challenges that they need in a variety of areas. But we're also attentive to the times when, hey, they've been pounding on that homework for 45 minutes right now, and they just need a break. They got to stop, get up, you know, walk around and let their mind go into mind wandering mode for a few minutes before we try and push them back into focused mode. So I think it's important to know that there are limits to what they can do and to be attentive to that, right? That's part of what you're gauging for as you try and lead your child to grow in a whole bunch of different areas.
That's great. I want to take a quick break and come back. And I think, you know, the tendency as humans, Jason, is we tend to, what motivates us personally, we think everyone's excited about. And we also realize, especially when we're in a classroom or we have multiple children, God wired everybody differently. So it, just because we're geeking out over something doesn't mean that that's instantly interesting to our children. And so how do we work within, you know, what are some of the best practices both in homes and in schools to really meet the child where they are and then bring them to that point of flow of awareness, of curiosity that leads to rightly ordered motivation? So I can't wait for your answer. We'll be right back after this break.
He's worked with families for more than 30 years as a licensed professional counselor and marriage family therapist. It's time for a quick encouragement on the best practices of raising the next generation. We call it a McCurdy moment.
So Keith, as you interact with parents around the country and on speaking and engagement opportunities, do you find parents push back at this idea of, hey, let your kids do more, get out of their way, quit over-parenting? Does that meet resistance?
You know, it's not really pushback. It's more like fear and anguish on their faces.
Because the reality is one of the toughest things as parents is to step back and give our children more responsibility for the simple reality that it always takes longer and it's messier. You know, it's, I would just rather pour that milk because I know if Johnny pours the milk, you know, only half of it's going to be in the glass and then it's on the floor and we got to deal with all that. And what I tell parents is, you know, this is really where we understand true leadership. You know, parental leadership has two key characteristics. One is it's ordained. It's a job given to us by God. But the second is it's sacrificial. And the sacrifice in leadership is understanding that who we lead, that's who we're trying to benefit. You know, we're trying to benefit those we lead. And to do that, our sacrifice is putting up with the painful process of it taking longer and being messier for them to master skills in life. And so it is a common frustration. We've all been through it. And yet that's the pushback I get. It's not that people disagree. It's like, oh no, they get it. This is exactly what we need to be doing. But oh my goodness, it's going to be messier. It's going to take twice as long. We're going to be late everywhere. But until we turn that over to our kids, it will never improve. Yeah.
And it's as a universal principle, I mean, in the workplace, if you don't delegate a few things, you end up doing everything. And that's not what you want either. So empowering others is part of that process, is certainly as parents. That's a great word, Keith. Thank you so much. Got a question for Keith to answer on a future McCurdy Moment? Well, send it to us at info@basecamplive.com and learn more about Keith McCurdy on the speaking page on the Basecamp Live website. Jason, love this topic. I'm very motivated now to keep going, but our time is always short here. I'm thinking about, you know, I'm blessed. Holly, my wife, and I are blessed with three children. They're all very different. They're motivated differently. And how do we make sure that just because we get excited about playing a piano or reading the great books, that our child, and I have a child who's very much into kind of the common arts. He's been blessed by classical Christian education, but he'd rather be out in the garage with me restoring a car than probably diving back into another philosophy lesson, which is different than maybe my other child. So how do we meet children in the home and in the school in a way that really meets them where their natural motivation is going to be?
Yeah, I love that question because it's so important here as a parent, but also as a teacher, as educators at our classical Christian schools, to have a healthy dose of realism about the fact that, like you said, not all students are the same. They're not all going to be, you know, like Latin buffs at the end of the day. And that's okay. And so I think we should hopefully maybe disabuse ourselves of the notion that just because we send our kids to a classical Christian school, they're going to be a particular sort of intellectual. That's not what classical Christian education is. Even if we actually value those things in ways that other schools don't anymore. And so I think it's important to be aware, right, when you think about your kids in a class, if you're a teacher listening to this, or the different kids that you have and how they're wired, they're not all going to be wired the same. And that doesn't mean something's wrong. That doesn't mean you failed the motivation game for them as a teacher or parent. There are going to be times in any good school where some students are going to have to just grit it out through certain types of things and do the what's required of them. And that's actually good, too, because as human beings, we have obligations and we won't like or love everything that we're required to do. I don't know that there's any job out there where you get to just do things that you love most all the time. I mean, I know that that's what a lot of books are about these days. There's probably ads telling you you can, you know, just write for a living and, you know, stay on the beach in Jamaica. And maybe some people can do that. But the point is that in the real world, we do have to do things that are hard and things that we don't love. And that's okay. They actually need to learn that too as a lesson. And they need to be properly motivated also by doing what's required of them, what they ought to do, even when they want to do something different. That's good. And so all these lessons kind of fit in their different places, I think. And it is important to feed the interest that they do have, because at least part of what education is about is being exposed to this wide array and you might call it a buffet of great skills, arts, ideas, areas of knowledge. and dabbling in all of them for many years, right? So that your kid is well exposed to develop the things that they love most over time and the things that they're most naturally gifted at as they still work hard at some of the other things. There will come a day for many of them where they're just going to pick what they're going to study on their own. And it might not be the subject that you teach, right?
Well, and I think that's just it. I mean, I would hate for someone to hear this and think, okay, well, they're just saying it's not carrots and sticks, but it's more noble. You know, it's not a worldly carrot. It's a noble God-given carrot of, you know, loving the true, good, and beautiful. We'll put that out in front. Well, I think the reality is there's just going to be times where you just got to work hard. And I'm sorry, you know, there's nothing true, good, and beautiful maybe about taking the trash out or something, but there's a point at which we're just going to have to labor. And that is not in the narrative of our modern culture. In fact, this is part of, I think, the problem with the lack of workers in the modern workforce is that they've bought into this notion, as you're mentioning, that if it doesn't sort of strike you as exciting and fun in the moment, then don't do it, as opposed to no, that's work is not always fun or pleasant, but there's a more noble purpose that motivates us. So,
yeah, but then given that kind of as a base level, we're all going to have to do things that we don't necessarily want to do. You will too, child, right? I do at work. We're all on the same page here. We live under, you know, a world that God has made. It's good, but it's not perfect. We can then say, all right, well, given that you have these strengths and these inclinations, let's see if we can maybe turn some of the other things you have to do in a way that fits with your natural interests and inclinations. And I think that's a great thing that teachers can do, where, you know, there actually should be a great variety in the schoolroom of types of projects and learning and engagement that's going on. I think classical Christian education gives a great feast to all with many different types of things to enjoy. And they won't all enjoy the same things as much as other things, right? There's going to be variety. And so that's the great thing about education in some ways, is getting to see what students really light up at what. And it won't be the same all the time. But the fact that that one student is lighting up in Latin class or in that history session or another is actually going to help create that culture of curiosity and learning, right? You want to highlight those moments and give those moments time to shine. And that's going to help all of us as a learning community to really appreciate everything. So yeah, we want to get some common arts in the curriculum. We want to integrate them with the liberal arts. And by that, I mean, just things with your hands, where you're getting to build or create or perform a laboratory experiment or do many of these other things that connect with, you know, what's going on in terms of, you know, the numbers and the calculations and the paragraphs that students are writing, right? Like all these things are different parts of reality and they're interrelated, and we want them to see the beauty of the whole and experience it from all different angles.
Well, and yeah, I was just thinking one of the joys of having been parenting and educating now for, well, probably more than two decades is seeing the fruit of students and my own children that back in the day kind of maybe resisted some of the teaching or the instructing, but because they were rightly, eventually they owned that, that habit, that culture, and it became who they were. And now they're rightly motivated. And that's a beautiful thing to see. Once they get in, you know, begin to own those motivations, it is a beautiful thing, and it's really what we're all about as parents and educators in classical Christian schools. So, Jason, kind of in a final comments or just final admonitions, encouragements, first to parents who are listening in this area of motivation, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I just reiterate to be careful about the motivation tactics that you use. And to think, again, in these bigger categories of culture and habits for your kids, specifically do things together as a family, whether that's reading or family projects. You want to create a network of positive associations for your kids with meaningful types of activities that you'll do as a family, and then like share those family memories from what you did, whether it was some sort of common arts project together or a trip, you know, a vacation to some destination, put a like museum in there and have a great time together. Don't stay too long and try and do everything at the museum, but like make it fun and enjoyable. Think about the context of those things and what you would enjoy, and try and lift them up through that whole family culture that you have. For you teachers listening to this, if you're still using behavior charts or something like that, you know, talk with your administrators and let's think about that a little bit better from a classical Christian perspective and see how instead we can focus on habits, the habits of the heart for our students, and how we can sow living ideas in them and create a compelling counterculture that really will get them on board with the type of education we're giving them.
Well said, Jason. Well, thank you so much again for being on Basecamp. Just give you a moment here to put a quick plug in, especially towards, you know, for educators, the work you're doing with Educational Renaissance. You have your own podcast and webinars. Just share a little bit about the resources that you guys make available.
Yeah, thanks so much. Educational Renaissance exists to promote a rebirth of ancient wisdom for the modern era. And we've got a lot going on that website. Just search Educational Renaissance. You'll find there, again, you can access our podcast. We've got webinars going on. We're just launching a second book, and we'll have more on the way, really to help teachers, home educators, classical Christian school leaders. We've just got a host of great resources where we're tying back some modern learning science and elite performance research with the ancient wisdom that we all know and love from the classical tradition. So come and find us over there. I and two other guys, Dr. Patrick Egan and Colby Atchison, are running that. So thanks for highlighting that.
Absolutely, Jason. Love what you guys are doing. Appreciate your being kindred spirits here in this movement as we continue to advance the work of classical Christian schools and certainly our students and motivate them correctly. So thanks for your great wisdom and encouragement today.
Hey there, Basecamp Live listeners. This is Davey's daughter, Hannah, here. And I want to congratulate this amazing podcast on almost 5 years of incredible content, enriching interviews, and over 200 episodes. So that has brought so much encouragement to people. And thank you for being a part of that. Thank you for supporting this message, this mission. And there are a couple ways that you can help in sharing that message. First of all, please leave a 5-star review on whatever app you are using to listen to this podcast. You can also share it with a friend. That's a great way to get the message out about Basecamp Live. And of course, share your story with us at info@basecamplive.com. There we'll also answer all your questions and more. And any topics that you'd like to hear too, please send them there to info@basecamplive.com. We'll see you next week, everybody. Thanks.